The House Committee on Elections will come to order. Thanks everyone for coming. As you know, this is obviously an interim hearing, and we will be hearing two bills today, but we can't and won't be acting on them. That includes amendments. There were none that were submitted, but even had there been, we wouldn't have acted on those amendments today. So we won't be acting on prior minutes or anything of the kind, and just as a procedural matter, we won't be making motions on the bills either. These are two separate presentations on bills that have been pre-filed and that presumably will be back before this committee when we gavel into session on February 25th. So this really is an opportunity for a preview of these bills. Can everyone hear? No? Better? Can you hear now? Okay. I was just saying that this is an interim hearing, obviously, and that we're not going to be acting on these bills. We're not even going to make motions on the bills. These are just two independent presentations on two important issues, and there are two bills that have been pre-filed, so they are live bills. This isn't just a concept or an idea. They're two actual bills before us. And I see this as a beginning, not an end. I think this committee's had an extraordinary record of coming up with final products that are the result of many people's work. And so, too, with these bills. They already are, to a large extent, and I think they'll only continue to be. So this is a beginning, not an end. There's no vote today, and this is a time for people to talk about what they like and what they don't like about these particular bills so we can fashion something that hopefully will get consensus support. So the first bill is my bill, and I'll hand over the chair duties to Vice Chair Representative Halverson.
Simon, whenever you are ready, I think that we are ready to hear an overview of House File 2096.
Sure. Can everyone hear that? Is this mic? Okay. Okay. Thanks, Madam Chair and members and everyone who's here today for hearing and listening to some testimony here on House File 2096. Yeah, I think at our best, we on this committee and we as a legislature are all about opening doors for all eligible Minnesota voters, not slamming them in people's faces. And that's what we have been about. I think in a bipartisan way over the last year, we've done that as a committee in a bipartisan way, whether it was the use of the new No Excuses Absentee Voting law, which thanks to bipartisan work is now the law of the land, or expanding vote by mail possibilities for folks who live in townships. I think we've done a good job of working together, and I'm hoping we can on this issue as well. I think, speaking of opening doors, it really is time in Minnesota to harness technology to open those doors for voters and to make voting and registering to vote more accessible for everyday people. I think it's an idea whose time has come. According to the National Conference on State Legislatures, or NCSL, 19 states now have online voter registration, 13 in which that is fully implemented, another 6 where it is on the way, it's sort of pending. And I might add, it's a good division of sort of stereotypically blue states and stereotypically red states. The red states including the likes of Utah, South Carolina, and Kansas. So this is by no means a partisan initiative. It's one that benefits everyone and all walks of life, regardless of party and regardless of location. And it just seems to me that in an era where we all transact so much business online, from buying gifts to booking airline flights, government should seek to offer the same convenience, and we already do. You can buy stamps online. You can apply or reapply for your license tabs for your car online, and now I think we should do the same for voting. A note about the current dispute. Let's just get it out there. As everyone in this room, I'm sure, knows, there's a dispute ongoing right now about whether the Office of Secretary of State had the authority to implement an online voter registration system. It did. others' objection. There was a lawsuit. That lawsuit and the result of it is now pending in Ramsey County District Court. The judge took testimony and heard oral argument on in mid-December, and sometime at least after mid-March. I say at least after because of some recent procedural additions, I guess I would say, it's now not clear whether it's mid-March or some date thereafter, but at some point the court will likely make a decision. So while reasonable people can disagree about whether the office did or didn't have authority, those arguments have already been fleshed out. And I don't think it's a great use of our time today, although no one can muzzle anyone in this room, to start talking about why the office took a certain position. And my hunch would be that the office would likely rely rightly on attorney-client privilege in terms of going into the reasons and the rationale for certain legal arguments. So, you know, anyone can talk about whatever they want here. I just don't think it's a very useful, a good use of our time, especially since even at the press conference announcing the lawsuit, there were some people who had, again, the good faith position that the office did not have the authority, who nonetheless made clear that they support, in a general way, the merits of online registration. That is to say, they think it's a good idea generally, but they just disagreed with the way that it was rolled out. And so because of that, I'd like to stick to the merits here today and talk about those merits. And I think you'll find from the testimony here, at least some of it, that overall, online voter registration and online ballot absentee ballot applications really are user-friendly, they're cheaper, and they're actually more reliable and more accurate. And there will be others who can more articulately explain why that is. So you're going to hear much more from other testifiers about the details here. But the basics of the bill, I don't think it's necessary to go over the bill line by line, chapter and verse, but the basics of the bill are it authorizes a system for submission of information online. It says that the paper form and the e-form, so to speak, have to match the same information. It grandfathers those in who have already been registered under the current system. It authorizes online absentee ballot applications as well. It authorizes special use of online absentee ballot applications for military and overseas voters. And it requires certification of website security. And on that last point in particular, I want to emphasize that this bill, even as just introduced, which is a beginning, not an end, has the fingerprints on it of Democrats and Republicans. There were members of both parties that had a hand in language in this bill, and in particular that last section. So, and some of them are in this room. So I really appreciate that, and I know that this is an ongoing process. So I think, Madam Chair, I think the best thing to do right now is just listen to the testifiers who have more to say and more detailed things to say than I do. And we're going to hear from proponents and we're going to hear from opponents. And I trust that the opponents, and I think they do, have some constructive ideas for how this bill can be improved and changed. And I see my job as author in listening to and taking seriously those suggestions for how to improve or change the bill. And, of course, listening to and taking seriously those who think it's a good idea and want us to move forward as quickly as possible. So with that, Madam Chair, I guess we'd be ready for the next testifier. And then maybe afterwards, I or others can answer specific questions about chapter and verse of the bill.
Thank you, Representative Simon. And we do have a number of people who have requested time to testify on this bill. The interest of keeping everybody on schedule today, we'll probably time things at about 3 minutes per testifier and allow some flexibility as needed, but just trying to keep us on time. And we can just go in order of the folks that are listed on the agenda. And the first person that we have to hear from is Deborah Erickson from Crow Wing County Taxpayer Services Manager, Chair Mako.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members.
Welcome to the committee.
Randy Schreifels from Stearns County Auditor Treasurer and representing Mako as well will also be testifying at the same time.
Okay, and if you could just repeat your name for the record.
My name is Deborah Erickson. I'm the Taxpayer Services Manager for Crow Wing County, and I'm also the Chair of the Elections Committee for the Minnesota Association of County Officers.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Randy Schreifels, the Stearns County Auditor Treasurer, also with Mako.
Thank you.
And I'd like to talk today about the online voter registration. This is something that counties have been looking for a number of years, something we've been asking for. In Stearns County and throughout other counties too, we've been doing a lot more business online, and this got to the point where this was a thing that the question was raised, why aren't we doing this, both by the board and other members in the community. So it certainly is more convenient for the citizen. Rather than driving to our office or mailing an application in, they can do it at home. Save the county a lot of time and money. In an odd year election, or odd year, we typically have about 20,000 voter registrations with a time commitment of probably over 1,000 hours. In an even year, we're over 30,000 voter registration applications. Oftentimes, the voter registration applications have missing information or things that are ineligible that takes a considerable amount of time to follow up on. And all these things get taken care of or are easily handled with online application. Sometimes the cards are also sent to the wrong county, causing other delays. So by having more accurate information and having things go quicker, our roster certainly can be more accurate, and that can help save time in the polling places as well. So I guess in general, we just see a lot of benefits for the citizen and saving time and money for the county and at the polling places.
And Madam Chair and members, in addition, we also strongly support the ability for the online absentee ballot applications as well. With the advent of no-excuse absentee voting, the counties are anticipating a significant increase in the number of voters who will be voting by absentee ballot. Currently, in order to receive an absentee ballot, voters must submit a signed application by mail, fax, or a scanned copy by email. If the application is incomplete or illegible, county staff must contact the voter or have the voter submit a new application before a ballot can be sent. With an online process that requires the voter to enter all the necessary information ahead of time, counties will be better able to complete the absentee ballot processing and serve the voter in a more efficient way without incurring additional costs. Additionally, historic trends have shown that the busiest absentee voting period are the last several days of the period before the election. With the ability to submit applications online, voters who suddenly find themselves unable to make it to their polling place on election day will have a better opportunity to request their ballot in a more timely manner and allow election administrators to more efficiently and effectively process those applications. Additionally, military and overseas voters who currently use the FPCA application form as required also benefit from online access. Because their application for absentee ballot also serves as an application for voter registration, the ability to apply for an absentee ballot online but not register to vote could have the unintended consequence of disenfranchising some of the military voters. We thank you for your time, and we encourage your support of House File 2096 and would be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you. Are there any questions from the committee? I actually have one question. Can you name any other county citizen business that takes place exclusively on paper where we haven't opened up opportunities for people to work with the county online? Or is this the most?
Well, I'm sure, you know, in our office we deal with platting, and some of that is still a paper-based system. But even with that, you know, the tax payment and recording of documents can be done electronically. So, right, it is an area that we're lagging. A few years ago, you know, we meet with the staff, and we talk about areas where we should put our priority on what we should do online, and you know, this came to the top of the list in our office, certainly, and I'm glad that it got addressed, so of course getting addressed. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Chair. Just a quick question. What do Target, Neiman Marcus, Michaels, Minsure, and healthcare.gov all have in common? Cybersecurity issues. Do you have those concerns at your local county levels? And what kind of assurances would citizens and voters have that we wouldn't be subject to those with major corporations or other major undertakings of the government?
We certainly have concerns as well. And I'm not, you know, a technology person or understand the system and the security in there, but I think that's something that should be looked at and make sure it's a secure system. One thing I'll remind you also is when we get to the election season, there's a number of voter registration drives. And although, you know, we appreciate and we encourage those efforts, you know, we're giving out hundreds of cards at a time to people that do the voter registration drives, and we don't see those cards back for, you know, a week or two. So, you know, that information is sensitive and it's out there already. By having them doing it online, in some ways, I think you are increasing some security there.
Thank you. And I believe, for your reference, Representative O'Driscoll, that we will have additional testifiers that will be able to provide some more details on that. That's what I understand. So, Representative Dowd.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to ask some really elementary questions. So I just want to ask you not to tell the auditor in Isani County that I'm asking elementary questions. My days as county commissioner, I'm sure he would expect me to remember all this, but can you just walk me through really briefly what the process was like before, you know, before an online voter registration system, what somebody did, and more specifically what I'm looking for is what was your workload, what did you have to do, what was your process, and then what does that process look like? How does it change because of online voter registration?
Madam Chair, Representative Dowd, with regard to the previous process for a paper application, a registration application that is completed in paper, the voter has a multitude of ways that they can request or receive an application. They can request one through the mail. Usually they can print one off of basically any city, county, or state website that has them. They can receive them through the League of Women Voters. There are numerous different organizations throughout the state where they can actually just pick up one, libraries, those type of things. They can fill out the application form, and then it was mailed, faxed, or emailed, scanned and emailed, into the county auditor's office or whoever happens to have the application address on the back of the application. So if it is addressed to the Secretary of State's office, it gets sent to the Secretary of State's office, who has somebody who has to sort them and mail them into the different counties. Same thing if it accidentally gets sent to Stearns County because the person picked it up at the Stearns County Library, mm-hmm. and it actually is a resident of Crow Wing County, the Stearns County Auditor's Office then has to return that by mail to our office. So at that point in time, when staff receives them, we then are required to enter all the information into the system. And in entering the information, you are researching first to see if this voter is currently registered in the state of Minnesota at that name, address, or any other address and the information that matches. Once that is determined, you then must make sure that you are accurately entering data entry, all of the information that is on the application form. Halfway through the process, if you realize that the voter did not include their Social Security, the last four of their Social Security number, or their Minnesota driver's license, you have to append the application or any other information that is required on the application. It gets sent to a pending status. A letter has to be sent to the voter to have them ensure that they completely correct and completely provide the information that's required, at which time you go back to the application again, complete entering the information, and submit it for final approval. At that time, a PVC card is sent to the voter to verify that they truly do live where they say they do. With the online process, the things that are changed is obviously the mail shuffle is taken out of the equation. Additionally, the voter cannot submit the application unless they've provided their Minnesota driver's license number or the last four digits of their Social Security number. At which point, that then goes through the pre-verification process to ensure that those numbers do match. And one step I did forget in the previous example is those numbers have to be verified anyway. So after staff has entered the information, before that final approval is done, that information with the driver's license or the Social Security number is verified through state resources. And then that final application is complete. The online part, that's done up front before we ever receive the applications in our queue. We then process the batch of queues and submit for final approval. So it cuts our time, cuts the amount of data entry errors that can be made, and ensures that the voter has completely provided the necessary information using pre-verified data before their application can be processed.
Representative Dowd.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that. So just a little more on what it looks like after online voter registration. So this, they go online. It comes to you, it only gets to you if they've entered the driver's license or the last four of Social Security, so that the system will catch those errors already. Does that automatically get I'm going to ask a few questions here so we don't have to go back and forth. Does that automatically get verified on the electronic system before it gets to you? And then I also am just curious about your thoughts on potential for fraud. If you see, I mean, one of the things I think everybody wants to increase access or decrease barriers to voting for people, but we want to make sure that we protect the integrity of our voting system. I mean, if we don't do that, then everybody's vote is worth less. And do you see any opportunities where there might be potential for fraud or anything like that? So those two questions. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative Doubt.
Ms. Erickson.
The first part of your question, as far as you're correct, the information will not get to us if the voter's driver's license number or the last four of their social security number cannot be verified. So that has to be verified before it ever gets to us to be processed. The second part of your question with regard to fraud, the same checks that are in place for the current process are in place for the online process as well. The voter still has to provide their information, and if a voter mails this application in, very first time, they've never been registered in Minnesota before, they fill out an application and they mail it to our office, there's already a check in the system that they have to show ID at the polls the first time they show up to vote. So unless they have presented themselves in person and filled out the application at our counter and somebody has seen their identification basically at that time, there's already a check in place that requires them to show identification at the polls before they vote for the first time. So the information that we're using from the electronic sources is if the voter is already currently a registered Minnesota voter, that process has already been done. If they're not already a registered Minnesota voter, that same request or that same notation will show up on election day.
Other questions? Thank you.
Thank you
for your time today. And next on the list is Dan McGrath from Minnesota Majority. Welcome to the committee. Just state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Dan McGrath, President of Minnesota Majority. Good afternoon, members. My testimony is not against online voter registration or necessarily for it, but rather to provide some suggestions on how to improve the bill and protect the integrity of Minnesota's election system. If done right, online registration can be a harmless and simple additional convenience for voters. It can assist county officials. If done wrong, however, it can be a wide open backdoor to abuse. Consider recent developments in Florida, where an online system for requesting absentee ballots was abused by criminals, making over 2,500 fraudulent requests for absentee ballots. In that case, the election software used by Miami-Dade County detected that the requests were suspicious only because of the frequency with which the requests were coming in. Investigators concluded that if the fraudsters had tweaked their apparently automated system to run slower, it may have gone unnoticed. This demonstrates the potential hazards of any online election system. I'd venture a guess that the hackers and fraudsters are smarter about information security than most of us in this room. So I urge you to think ahead and ensure that any online system related to our sacred elections is as secure, reliable, and transparent as possible. In my estimation, the bill before this committee is lacking in all of those respects, and I offer the following suggestions to improve the bill as a person who has studied the integrity of Minnesota's election system extensively for several years. First, the bill requires a verifiable state ID or driver's license number or the last four digits of an applicant's Social Security number to be used when applying online, but the bill does not specifically require the state to actually verify that data. We recommend that the bill require the Secretary of State or county officials to verify the numbers match the voter application data before approving any online application. Online applications rejected due to provision of ID numbers that don't match should be referred for investigation to county attorneys in the county the registration was intended for. The bill should require the Secretary of State to monitor and log IP addresses from which applications are received and should reject applications submitted via foreign servers or, at a minimum, add extra scrutiny to applications that are submitted via foreign servers. I add this caveat because in Florida, when investigators tried to determine what the source of those fraudulent applications was, they found that a lot of them came from foreign IP addresses. It was untraceable. They could not find the perpetrators. The bill should require the online application system to monitor for suspicious activity, such as multiple submissions from a single IP address, unusually high volume or rates of submission. When suspicious activity is detected, an investigation should be required. With the Secretary of State's current unilateral implementation of online voter registration, there is confusion about which jurisdiction has charging authority in cases of online registration fraud. House File 296 is introduced, does nothing to address this crucial issue, and we recommend that the bill contain explicit language specifying in the case of fraud which county or jurisdiction the crime shall have been committed in, and make plain which jurisdiction or jurisdictions have authority to charge and prosecute online registration fraud cases. We recommend that we require a standardized voter registration document for each online registration that is equivalent to the paper forms for retention by county auditors and for public inspection, and that should include the IP address that the registration or request for absentee ballot was submitted from. So these recommendations apply both to online registration and absentee ballot requests. Now, I understand that there's likely to be some objection to some of these suggestions on a basis of cost, but let me suggest that if we can't afford to do this right, let's not do it at all. Would you consider building a bridge without adequate funding to ensure its safety and utility? I wouldn't think so. If sufficient funding isn't available to build a bridge with sound structural integrity, the bridge doesn't get built, no matter how much some people may desire it. Please don't consider putting our election system at risk by allowing a shoddy online system. Do it right with all necessary and possible safeguards, or don't do it at all. Unfortunately, as was mentioned before, our Secretary of State has left us in a little bit of a pickle by implementing online voter registration without authorization from the legislature, and we at Minnesota Majority, with a number of legislators and another organization, Minnesota Voters Alliance, have initiated a lawsuit to enjoin that system. So we don't know at this point, since that case is still pending, whether the judge will halt that system or not, or whether it'll continue. This may present some challenges for the legislature, but should it happen that the system is allowed to continue by the courts, this legislature should still move swiftly to shore it up. If the system is struck down, the legislature should not replace it unless the system is extraordinarily sound. We're hoping to have a decision from the judge soon. Thank you for hearing my testimony. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. McGrath. Any questions? Thank you. Next, we'll hear from Beth Fraser and Gary Poser from the Office of the Minnesota Secretary of State. Welcome to the committee. And if you can just restate your name for the record, please.
Madam Chair, Gary Poser, I'm the Director of Elections for the Office of the Secretary of State. And I'll also testifying with me is Beth Fraser. So I'll be discussing a little bit about how the statewide registration system and the online system are maintained. So the Secretary of State has maintained a statewide system housing statewide voter registration system since 1988. We've had 26 years of securely maintaining that voter registration data. Currently, the statewide system is the third statewide voter registration system and was deployed in 2004 as part of the Help America Vote Act, and has been maintaining registration data containing driver's license numbers and last four digits of the Social Security numbers since that time. Online registration does not change our mission of securely storing voter registration data. We have had and will continue to have that mission regardless of how that data is gathered and input into the system. The Secretary of State's office, in conjunction with Minute, currently uses intrusion protection software where we do receive notifications of suspicious activity, and we currently do block IP addresses that might have suspicious activity, as well as Minute would block any suspicious activity, and those block numbers then would be prevented from accessing any of our systems. So all of our systems use that type of intrusion protection, not just online voter registration. The voter information portal, also referred to as VIP, has previously been in place on our website for voter registration status lookup and absentee status lookup. Voter information portal is also where the link to online voter registration is now accessed. The Secretary of State's office has run the voter information portal web pages through security checking software prior to deployment of the online registration system. One of the things that's certainly visible on our public website is that our URL contains the HTTPS protocol, that S meaning that there is encryption protocols within that system. I know that other state websites have been criticized in the past for allowing, even though they have that HTTPS as part of their URL, that the S could be removed and somebody could enter that URL and still get through a backdoor, being basically non-encrypted or not secure. Our system has always required the S to be there, and if the S was attempted to be removed, the system automatically puts basically that S back in there, and you are redirected continually to the secure URL. Access to the statewide voter registration itself is limited by a router ACL, basically meaning that those users must have static IP addresses, and the Secretary of State's office specifically allows those specific IP addresses from the counties to have access to the statewide registration system. And of course, the system does reside behind a firewall, and as I mentioned before, we do deploy intrusion prevention. The SVRS users themselves must have user IDs, passwords, and roles assigned to them, which limit the users to certain functions of the system. And currently, we have 20 state users, 240 county users, and 63 municipal users that have access to the statewide voter registration system data. We also do run monthly audit reports to seek out any unauthorized use of the statewide registration system. And Madam Chairman, that's my testimony, and I'll turn it over to Ms. Fraser.
Ms. Fraser, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Beth Fraser, Deputy Secretary of State. And I am happy to be here today to talk about the online voter registration and absentee balloting bill. As Representative Simon said, online voter registration is not a new concept. It was first introduced in 2002 by then Secretary of State in Arizona, Jan Brewer. It was then adopted by also Republican Secretary of State in Washington State. And so it is now in many states with both Democratic and Republican secretaries. And it has proved to provide incredible cost savings. In Arizona, the county clerks estimate that it takes about 83 cents to process a paper registration and 3 cents to process an online voter registration. And so it also, of course, provides great convenience to voters. In the 21st century, voters expect to be able to do things online, and this allows them to do that. We have provided in your packets screenshots of the online voter registration tool so that you can see that it provides all of the same information that's on the paper form. It requires all of the information, so if somebody tries to submit an application that would be deficient, that does not include all of the legally required information, they're told you can't submit this. You need to provide missing information. If somebody checks the box that indicates that they're not eligible to vote, it goes to a screen and says, if you're not a citizen, you're not eligible to vote. Ms. Erickson was explaining, it does require voters to provide a verifiable driver's license, state ID card number, or the last 4 digits of their social security number. And the way the tool is built is those records are matched against the statewide voter registration system and data that's already been verified that's in our system, or against the driver and vehicle services system, or against the Social Security Administration system. And only those for whom we can verify the information are forwarded to the counties for processing. And that's different than the paper system. In the paper system, counties type in the information, and because there's the possibility of both illegible handwriting, voters transposing digits, and or typos, that system is more forgiving. And so in that case, the counties are given possible matches. And so it would come up Elizabeth Fraser with a slightly different date of birth or a slightly different driver's license number. And the counties are required, in cases where there's not an exact match, to see whether this is the same person or whether it's actually somebody different, which is time-consuming. This only forwards on exact matches. So if a voter made a typo in their driver's license number, their date of birth, then their application would be rejected, and they would receive an email that says, I'm sorry, based upon the information you provided, it cannot be processed. Now, we don't believe that should be forwarded to the county auditors. We don't believe typos are crimes. But there are processes in place to be sure that only people who can be verified, who do exist in other government databases, only those applications are forwarded on. Which means you could not use the online system, for example, to register Mickey Mouse or somebody who does not exist in a database. The other benefit of using this system that the counties really like is we also require people to choose addresses from drop-down menus, which means that the addresses, by definition, fall within the precinct finder, which means that unlike other electronic records that they receive from driver and vehicle services, where they don't have the same address standards that we do, there they need to figure out, oh, they put in County 5, but that's Broadway Avenue, or County 77, or whatever it is. But, you know, they don't need to translate the addresses. In this case, they know any application that comes through this hits the precinct finder, and so it's less work for them. The other tool that was launched this past fall was for absentee ballot applications for military and overseas voters. And as Ms. Erickson was explaining, those double as voter registration applications. And so they count for both purposes. And we've currently had 55 people use those applications. The other tool that this bill would authorize are absentee ballot applications for regular absentee voters. And all three of the tools have the same security procedures in place so that voters have to provide a verifiable ID number, and if they don't, their application is rejected. Voters who successfully provide the information that is verified then receive an email address that says your application has been processed. You are now registered to vote and will receive a postcard. So all of the other procedures that are in place for pre-registered voters are in place for online registrants. They are mailed a postcard to verify their actual address, and they are run through all of the other security checks. So the real difference between the paper applications and the electronic applications, the online voter registrations, are the method of submission, are that voters are allowed to fill out these forms at the time and place that's convenient for them from the privacy of their own home. They're not being asked to fill it out at a bus stop and hand their private information to a stranger who hopefully will turn it in a few days later. And we have been receiving electronic applications from the Department of Public Safety, from Driver and Vehicle Services, since the previous secretary was in office, and have been automatically updating voters' registrations based upon national change of address electronically since 2009. So electronic registration is not a new concept, and I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Fraser, probably for you. Just wondering, in the last election, what percent of Minnesotans voted, how that compared nationally, and then do you anticipate a significant change in that with online registration?
Ms. Fraser.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Erdahl. In the last election, Minnesota again topped the nation in terms of voter turnout. I don't remember the exact percentage. I think it was around 76% of eligible voters in Minnesota turned out in the 2012 presidential election. What we're finding with the online registrations is it mirrors what other states have found, and that's that the vast majority of people using the system are simply updating current registrations. We've had approximately over 2,500 people use the system so far, and about 700 of them were new registrants, and about 1,400 of them were people who were already registered to vote and were updating their registration. And in terms of first-time voters who have to show ID, they have to show ID if their driver's license number or Social Security number cannot be verified. And all of the registrants through the online system are pre-registered and are, by definition, verified through the procedures.
Representative Ertl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Frazier, so would you say that the main objective in this is it cost savings? Is it convenience? Is it improving the system? What is it a combination? Or what is the main reason?
Ms. Frazier.
Madam Chair, Representative Ertl, I would say that it's all of the above. We've been hearing from voters who have seen online voter registration in other states that they want this. We've been hearing from counties for years that they want they want to be able to receive applications this way. And prior to the 2012 election, we're in conversation with counties who wanted it before the presidential election. Our hope is that this will not only provide greater convenience to voters and save counties much more than it costs the state to build the system, but that it also, because it's more convenient for voters, will help reduce the number of people who wait until election day to register to vote. We'll still have the 20-day cutoff, but if people can fill this out online and hit submit and get it done and not have to fill out the paper and figure out where to mail it or find a stamp or find somebody who's doing a voter registration drive, that will actually get more voters registered before election day than on election day. Because, well, same-day registration is a great convenience for Minnesota voters. It is more costly to administer than pre-registered voters. And we want to do all that we can to encourage folks to register ahead of time.
Any questions? Representative Dowd.
Thank you, and thank you, Ms. Frazier. I just wrote down some of the concerns the previous testifier had, and I know you touched on some of those, but if I just run down the list here, do you want to kind of address those individually? And then maybe I'll start with when somebody's filling this out online and they put in the wrong identification number, does that check against the DVS or Social Security records happen immediately? Do they get immediate feedback that that number's wrong and get an opportunity to enter a new number, or do they submit and then it comes back later and says with an email? What's the process for that?
Ms. Frazier.
Madam Chair, Representative Dowd, it is not instantaneous. We did not build a system where that check is done instantaneously. There is an email, and it depends which database we're verifying against how quickly that email comes. It could come within 15 minutes, or it may take several days.
Representative Dowd.
Okay, I'm just going to run down the list of concerns that I think I wrote them down, all of them, and I'll just run down the list and you can weigh in. Some of these you already talked about. Non-matching numbers referred for investigation. I know you did address that a little bit. Maybe you can expound on that by adding, is there any circumstances that you guys do look for, and what are they in which you would look for suspicious activity that you'd be reporting for investigation for a potential voter fraud? Reject or scrutinize foreign IP addresses. I think the other testifier mentioned that briefly. Maybe you can expound on that as well. Monitoring suspicious activity, multiple applications from IP addresses, that was another concern. This bill doesn't specifically outline who has jurisdiction if fraud, and maybe this is something that's more up to the bill author to address. But if you'd like to weigh in on that. And then also, what records are retained? And this is one that previous testifier mentioned that kind of made sense. Are local officials retaining some sort of a document that has the official record of that online application that could, you know, that you could go back to later that had the IP address that grabbed all of the data that was pertinent, in case something did arise later where there was some suspicion of it being a fraudulent application. So maybe you can address those, and then I'll probably have another question or two.
Mr. Poser?
Madam Chair, Representative Dowd, I'll take the first stab, I think, at trying to answer your questions. As I mentioned before, we do monitor suspicious activity based on, you know, that could be the frequency of an IP address that's attempting to hit the system. As I mentioned before, in conjunction with Minute, we have software that, if that were to occur, it actually would notify our responsible person who's responsible for our equipment in that sense, and he would get like some type of a notification. I don't believe, it probably is like an email that he gets to him that says, you know, there's something going on with this IP address. He would look at it. He could immediately block that IP address, and once that's blocked, any of the other systems throughout the state that are going through Minute using that same intrusion prevention, they would be blocked from those systems as well. As far as the IP address, we are logging each IP address that does submit each individual application. It's my understanding that IP addresses are actually private data, so they are logged. They're not specifically on any reports that we give to the county auditors. But I think this would be analogous to the same situation where a county auditor currently might be suspicious of getting, you know, 200 voter registration applications on the same day, and they've never gotten those on the same day before. You know, they would look at those closer and see if they thought there was anything amiss with those. I think Dakota County had a situation like that, you know, a dozen years ago or so. Similarly, when we train the county auditors, this is the same system. You know, somebody might not even use the same IP address, I guess, if they wanted to try and submit a lot of voter registration applications. First of all, they would have to know all of the data for that individual. They'd need to know their name, their date of birth, their driver's license number, or the last four digits of the Social Security number. If they don't know those things, they won't be able to match into our existing system or into driver's license and vehicle services, and so they would never be queued up to a county. So in that sense, the county couldn't see those. If, however, I guess if somebody did know all of those things and was successful in submitting them, I think the same, you know, the Isanti County Auditor, if they saw that all of a sudden in one day they had 50 registrations queued up and they've never had more than two in a day prior, I think that individual, just like if they got paper copies, would be suspicious of that and take more action. And, you know, I do believe if there were prosecutions, you know, we could generate a list of who all, of what specific IP address, which voter registration applications came through those. Again, I don't think those would be put out for public inspection because I believe from our internal counsel, I was told that IP addresses were private data. And I'm not sure if I've answered all of your questions or if you still had one I didn't answer. Oh, retention of records. Yes. As far as retention of records, we do obviously now have an electronic record of each of these submissions, which at this point we've never removed any electronic submissions, whereas the paper copy, as you'll know, only has a 22-month retention period. So once a county has input that data into the statewide system, the paper copy is just an application and input document, and after 22 months they can be destroyed. Everything that happens within the statewide registration system is logged and is kept, and I don't know if that we would ever be destroying any of that data. The counties do have access to reports that they can run of every application that has been queued up for them to process and what the status of that record is. They can run that over the entire period. They could run it for a specific day. If they were looking for a specific application, they could go down and find that. But they could right now, they can run this report by date range. So from the very first record that came through and was queued to them, they will have that, and they'll have that forever, basically, at this point. That information is not being dropped off. It will always be retained within the statewide registration system.
Representative Dowd.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate you kind of going into a little more detail on these issues. I think I see Representative Driscoll isn't here any longer, but his question about what do all of these things have in common, data privacy and security concerns have become probably the biggest issue right now with all of these breaches of people's personal data. From credit card information to social security numbers to all of the other things that are out there right now. So I will comment that, and I know that the author and chair of the committee commented earlier that he didn't want to go into that this debate is really about the bill and not about the fact that this was implemented by the Secretary of State's office without legislative approval. I want to comment on that, and I'm not going to belabor the point, but the fact that this bill grandfathers in all of the people who would have registered through the system prior to this bill's enactment certainly brings all of those things into relevancy in this committee and in this format. But and I'm not going to question you about it, but and maybe somebody else will. I don't know, but I just want to say I think with all of the increased attention that personal privacy and security of that data is receiving right now in the media, I would think that the Secretary of State's office would want to go through every extra step to make sure that we are answering all of the concerns of the public and making sure that we're treating this data absolutely in the utmost, to protect that personal data and make sure that it's not misused or abused in any way. So I hope that that's happening, and I think that I just want to express my own personal disappointment that the Secretary of State's office moved forward without legislative approval on this, because this really is the format for people to come in and talk about what their concerns are. And I think what happened was we didn't give the public the opportunity to do that by just moving forward with the system without the legislative approval. So, and I know that there was bipartisan discontent with the fact that it moved forward that way. And I know we're debating this bill, and I want to keep the debate, or my comments to that. But I did want to just express that I do. I am disappointed that the Secretary of State's office moved forward without that. And finally, I think I'll just ask one last question, and maybe then make a comment. And maybe it's a couple of questions. Number one, how much did you pay for the contractor to put this system in place? What did it cost the taxpayers to implement this system so far? And more importantly, are you 100% positive that this system is secure and you can tell the public in the state of Minnesota that this data is protected, it is secure, and there won't be any problems?
Ms. Frazier.
Madam Chair, Representative Dowd. One of the things that I think it's really important that this committee understand is that introducing this tool changes almost nothing. The state has had an online voter registration system for years that the counties have all accessed remotely. And so the data has been out there and has been secure for decades. And so, and we've been receiving data electronically from other agencies for decades. And so the only thing that we've done is added one additional way for voters to submit their data. So the questions about voter security are paramount and have been paramount in the Secretary of State's office under Secretary Ritchie's administration, and I assume under Secretary Kiffmeyer's administration as well. And that is something we care about and pay attention to every single day. The system is secure. I actually heard that one of your colleagues suggested that perhaps Secretary Ritchie should have been in charge of building another high-profile database, because we seem to be successful at building high-profile online databases. But the cost to the taxpayers of building this system are approximately $55,000. About $50,000 of that was from the general fund, and about $5,000 of that were from Help America Vote Act funds. The cost of building the online tool for military and overseas voters was about $65,000, $70,000 from Help America Vote Act funds. The average cost from other states is about $240,000. And I think that the reason that our costs were less was because we already had built several online tools to allow voters to look up the status of their voter registration, to look up the status of their absentee ballot applications. And those tools actually require the voters to enter exactly the same sensitive data that they're required to enter in this case as well.
Thank you. Representative Dowd.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I thank you, Ms. Frazier. And you and I have had a very good working relationship over the years. While we've differed on a couple of issues in the past, I think we both respect each other, and I thank you for your candor. Sounds like your system cost about $125,000 total. I will not be as kind on the other system the state is implementing. And I think, you know, right now Minnesotans are losing their faith in what government is doing, and I appreciate you being here and doing what you can to regain that faith. But this MNsure system, you know, maybe whoever your contractor was should apply for that, because something that cost you $125,000 to do, MNsure has now spent over $150 million, and they just got an independent report last week saying that they need to start over from scratch. And I'm hearing about it in my district, and I'm sure that other representatives are as well. It's absolutely unacceptable. So I appreciate that you're here, and it sounds like you guys are making every effort. While I mentioned that I wish you'd have done this first and not implemented the system and then come to the legislature afterwards, I certainly do appreciate you being here and talking about it. So and maybe I would like to get the vendor's number, because I think we should talk to them about coming to work on the MNsure system.
Madam Chair, just to clarify, the system was primarily built in-house by in-house IT staff. We do have one contractor who augments our IT staff, but and they are
they're not available.
I know we've got a couple more questions for these testifiers, and I just want to remind folks that we're dealing with time crunch, as usual, and so want to be sure that people stay focused on the bill at hand. Representative Winkler?
Thank you, Madam Chair. That was inspired to talk about the minimum wage by Representative Dowd's speech about MNsure, but I'll try to confine myself to something else.
We'll save that for the House floor, right?
I just have, first of all, congratulations on doing this very well, and I think using your office appropriately. Just one really simple question. People get an email, it could take days, saying that there's something wrong with their registration. Is there a confirmation email that everybody gets at some point saying your registration was received and approved?
Ms. Frazier.
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler. Yes, they do. They receive both a confirmation page at the end of the process saying your data has been submitted, as well as after the county has processed their application, an email saying you are now registered to vote. You will receive a postal verification card in the mail.
Representative Winkler.
Okay, and Madam Chair and Ms. Frazier, so basically when you finish your registration online, you are expecting some further communication from the Secretary of State's office.
Ms. Frazier.
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, yes.
Thank you.
Thanks. Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, Ms. Frazier, I just got a couple questions. One is on the paper form, Section 8 requires a signature, is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, yes.
And on the new, Madam Chair, Ms. Frazier, on the new electronic form, instead of a signature, you have to type in your name. And you quote on the form, it goes under Section 325L.07, which is the electronic signature form. It deals with the laws of electronic signatures back from 2000. And in that, when that law was written, it didn't deal with typing in a person's name. It dealt with photocopies and electronic photographs, basically, of a person's signature. With typing in a name, anybody could type in a person's name. The reason we have a signature is because it's an individual to that particular person. With the just typing it in, it makes me concerned that anybody could type anybody's name in. We, as Representative Driscoll stated earlier, you talked about Target. In, I believe it was 18 days, between 70 and 100 million people's private information, their account information, and a lot of them, their Social Security numbers were taken along with their addresses. With that information, anybody could register anybody falsely for voter registration, especially if you don't have an actual signature. Because if you have that information, you also have their name. You just type in their name. Do you have any concerns about somebody doing that?
Ms. Fraser?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, I have a different understanding of the origins of 325L, the Uniform Electronic Signatures Act, and that it actually was in reference to the increasing use of online technology, and that type signatures have actually been recognized as a legal signature going back to the days of the telegraph, as long as it is intended to be a signature. Some of the questions that you're raising could be similarly asked of paper forms. But the other thing to keep in mind is that this is voter registration. This is not voting. This simply gets your name onto the list of voters. And then one still needs to appear in person at the polling place or apply for an absentee ballot and vote. It does not cast the ballot.
Representative Johnson? Thank you. Representative Sanders?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Fraser, or perhaps Mr. Poser, you mentioned the audit. Chair Simons got reports to the legislature. When you reconcile the voter registrations across the board, whether they be now electronically or from voter registration cards, is it only audited internally by the Secretary of State's office, or is there another entity that also audits or reconciles that? Is there someone that audits the Secretary of State's office with voter registration information with actual voter output?
Ms. Fraser?
Madam Chair, Representative Sanders, I'm not sure I understand the question about the audit. I'm sorry.
Sure. You use the word that you audit or you reconcile voter registration with the actual card or the individual.
Madam Chair, Representative Sanders, we verify the information provided by voters in accordance with the Help America Vote Act. And in the case of online registrations, before they are even queued with counties, based upon voters' names, dates of birth, and identification numbers to ensure that there is a match and that they exist in another government database.
And Madam Chair, Ms. Fraser, what's the timeline for that? How long does it take to reconcile that?
Madam Chair, Representative Sanders, I think the other point I first want to make is that it's the counties that actually do that verification process. The state really is just the conduit. So if a county puts the information into the statewide registration system that evening, we send a file out to the Department of Public Safety if there's a driver's license number, or to Social Security Administration if it was the last four digits of the Social Security number. So it's every evening new data that was changed that hasn't been verified before would be sent to those government databases for checks. That's done overnight in a batch system. The next day that file would be received back by our office from Public Safety. We would then load that up. If the system found that it was an exact match, we would simply update, the system would basically update the record and say it's been matched. If there were potential matches or things couldn't be matched, those records are queued up for the county auditors, and the county auditors would review those records to make further determinations.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chair Simon, Section 6, the certification of the website, security report to the legislature. Could you talk a little bit about what you hope the legislature will receive out of that? I mean, it's descriptive in here. I get that. And then potentially what recourse the legislature would take, or if it's found inadequate, that report, just by chance, what can the legislature do?
Representative Simon?
Madam Chair, Representative Sanders, thanks. This is one of those provisions I know that you and I talked about, some sort of report or verification. I know that on the Senate side there was also some concern or even insistence that this be put in the bill, and that's why it's in the bill. I think the underlying rationale is just to provide some comfort, frankly, to legislators and to the public. In terms of recourse, you know, I think that this committee, or really any other committee, well, primarily this committee, would always have the ability to come in after the fact and impose certain restrictions or mandates or requirements to make sure it was a better system. So it's there as a safety valve. I know that you and others were concerned about it, but, you know, we can talk now or offline about how best to do that and put in that confidence-building measure, you might say. So.
Representative Sanders?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chair Simon. I think for the most part, we can talk offline and continue to strengthen some of that. I think you've done this the right way, and we're certainly moving in the right direction. One last question for you, Chair Simon. Will there be a fiscal note that accompanies this when this comes to the committee?
Representative Simon.
Madam Chair, Representative Sanders, I'm not sure at this point.
Okay.
I'm not sure.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question for Ms. Frazier. Is the online voter registration system currently open and accepting registrations, or has that been temporarily halted for pending legislation, pending lawsuits? What's the status right now?
Ms. Frazier.
Madam Chair and Representative Sanders, the system is still online and available. Voters register year-round. We had a special election yesterday?
Today.
In St. Louis County and Stearns County, one of those S counties, and with March Township elections coming up, you know, people register year-round.
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Frazier, I appreciate that, and we certainly want a system that's as accessible and expands accessibility and expands integrity as much as we can in everything that we look at. And I think that we've had a really good track record of being able to do that in this committee, and that's why it's frustrating to me to be here today. It's almost a question of why are we here? If this online voter registration is still up and running, if we're grandfathering the folks in, why do we need a law? Why do we need a bill that passes through the legislature to do that? I don't understand why we're here. I appreciate Representative Simon the way you're doing this. I don't know, Ms. Frazier, why we couldn't have had this conversation last February. I know the Secretary of State's office was talking about this prior to last February, last session. I think we could have had this conversation then. I think we could have had good results. I think we could have done it the right way. I think we could have stood up for the institution of the legislature. But it almost feels like a rubber stamp here today. And, you know, I hope that's not what this is. I respect Chair Simon a whole lot. But if the online voter registration system is still up and operational, I don't really know what we're doing here. But Chair Simon, I'll be happy to work with you, and hopefully we can get a good product here. Just not sure what it's going to accomplish.
Thank you. Any other questions for these testifiers? Thank you. And thanks for spending the time. I know that we were going to try to limit testimony, but I think that this conversation was important because we got into a lot of details of the bill, so I appreciate your time. Next, we'll hear from Sherry Knuth from the Minnesota League of Women Voters. League of Women Voters of Minnesota. Welcome to the committee. Welcome. You can state your name for the record.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for allowing us to testify this afternoon. My name is Susan Sheridan Tucker, Executive Director of the League of Women Voters, Minnesota, and with me is Sherry Knuth, our Policy and Outreach Manager. This year, the League of Women Voters, Minnesota, will be marking its 95th anniversary of ensuring that every citizen's right to vote is protected. Today we have 36 local leagues in communities across Minnesota, in Greater Minnesota, inner city neighborhoods, and the suburbs. Our members produce nonpartisan voters' guides, host and moderate hundreds of nonpartisan forums and debates across the state, register voters, and answer questions from voters about elections. Our state office also runs a hotline before major elections, taking calls from voters who have had a wide variety of questions about elections. These experiences help to inform the proposals that we support at the legislature. We often hear from election administrators, as well as our fellow League of Women Voter members across the country, that Minnesota is well respected for how we run elections. However, there are areas in which Minnesota needs to modernize its election system. One area is ensuring that online voter registration is available.
Online voter registration is recommended in two very recent national reports. Sherry Knuth, Policy and Outreach Manager for League of Women Voters. The two reports are a bipartisan report by the Presidential Commission on Election Administration and a nonpartisan report by the Pew Charitable Trusts. In addition, the National Conference of State Legislators calls online registration a bipartisan trend in elections. Online voter registration has proven successful in other parts of the country in saving taxpayer dollars, protecting the integrity of the system, and improving voters' experiences. Online registration systems eliminate costly steps involved with paper-based systems, among them transcribing handwritten forms. Indeed, League of Women Voters Minnesota yesterday received a request from a county auditor asking us to utilize online voter registration forms whenever possible when registering citizens to vote, because it would ease the auditor's burden of entering data from handwritten forms. Online registration systems are more accurate. In addition to easing administrative burdens, they contribute to moving voters through the polls more quickly on election day, because election judges do not have to address inaccuracies in the roster. Online registration also ensures a voter a privacy in his or her registration information. The League supports voter registration by non-governmental organizations in our communities. Local LWVs throughout Minnesota help register voters using paper registration forms, and we protect the privacy of each individual's personal information. We recognize, however, that a voter retains greater control over personal information when he or she is able to submit a registration request online. Indeed, non-governmental organizations such as the League will be able to help voters use online registration in some settings. Online registration would also provide greater ease in registering voters for the voters themselves, including busy working parents, citizens with mobility issues, the elders in our community, and people who assist their elderly parents or friends in the community. In addition, the report by the Presidential Commission states, studies of online registration show that younger voters are more likely to register when online tools are available. Finally, League of Women Voters supports providing for electronic applications. For absentee voting. Like online registration, electronic applications for absentee ballots save taxpayer dollars and improve voters' experiences. We urge you to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions for these testifiers? Seeing none, I'll thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And we can hear from Steve Schmidt from the Minnesota Disability Law Center and Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid. And we're closing in on the end of our time here together, and I want to be sure that our testifiers get as much time in front of committee as they can. So if you can keep your comments brief. Thank you,
Madam Chairwoman and members of the committee. My name is Steve Schmidt. I'm a staff attorney with the Minnesota Disability Law Center, statewide project of Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid. Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid is the federally mandated protection and advocacy system for individuals with disabilities. We represent individuals with all types of disabilities throughout the state. Our office receives funding through the Help America Vote Act to protect and advocate for the voting rights of people with disabilities in a nonpartisan fashion. I'm here today to testify on how House File 2096 will help individuals with disabilities exercise their right to vote. Historically, people with disabilities have faced significant barriers to registering and voting, and unfortunately, these barriers have led individuals with disabilities to vote at a much lower rate than the general population. We believe this bill will make it easier for individuals with disabilities to vote, and we encourage people with disabilities, and will encourage people with disabilities to more fully engage in the political process. As been said, there are currently at least 19 states that have adopted online voter registration. We urge Minnesota to follow the lead of these other states and the recommendation of the Presidential Commission on Election Administration, which stated earlier this month that more states should adopt online voting registration and codify online voter registration into law. The Commission found in its report that the ease of registering online increases voter registration and removes barriers to participation by voters with disability. Online voter registration will also save money in the time of high budget deficits and shrinking resources for programs that individuals with disabilities rely on. We believe it's good policy to implement election reforms such as online voter registration, which will reduce costs, increase efficiencies, and allow individuals with disabilities to more fully engage in the voting process. Of course, any system of online voting registration must be accessible to individuals with disabilities. To ensure accessibility of Minnesota's online voting registration, we suggest adding additional language to House File 2096 that includes the requirement that Minnesota must follow under anti-discrimination laws and ensures that an access expert will be included in the development of the online voter registration system. And I have some copies of the language that I'll pass around. And we believe this language will strengthen the bill and make certain that individuals with disabilities will have access to Minnesota's online voter registration system. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to testify about how House File 2096 will help individuals with disabilities exercise their right to vote.
Thank you, Mr. Schmidt. Do we have any questions in the committee? No. Thank you for your time.
Thanks.
And we'll distribute your handouts. Andrew Tim from McAllister College in MPERC. Welcome to the committee. You can just restate your name for the record, please.
Hi, my name is Andrew Tim from McAllister College from MPERC, Minnesota Public Interest Research. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Andrew Tim, and I'm a junior at McAllister College in St. Paul and a co-chair of the McAllister chapter of MPERC, the Minnesota Public Interest Group. I'm here today to testify in support of House File 2096. Part of MPERC's mission is to promote activism and civic involvement among students, and every year we do large nonpartisan voter registration drives on our campuses to encourage participation in democracy. In 2012, we registered over 10,000 young Minnesotans to vote. Voter registration is a major part of our work, and we were pleased when Secretary Ritchie introduced an online voter registration tool in Minnesota. We feel this should be an option, a permanent option for Minnesota voters. Online voter registration is a common sense tool for Minnesotans, but more importantly for young Minnesotans in particular. We expect to be able to do many things online. We can pay tuition online, manage our money, and even file police reports. In writing this testimony, I thought back to the last time I was required to fill out a form physically, and that was actually the time I registered to vote when I moved to the cities, which is sort of amusing. Putting voter registration online does not change the actual procedures of registration. It simply provides another, more accessible pathway to registering. Beyond aligning our voter registration system with the expectations of voters, there are other advantages. The tool ensures the information collected in a registration form is more secure than when submitted online. Online submission reduces errors in data, which makes the system more reliable for voters and can save local governments money as well. The most important benefit, however, of online registration is increased access to voting. With the registration form online, more Minnesotans will have the opportunity to register to vote, and as a result, will show up prepared on Election Day. What might be called convenience becomes a critical improvement in accessibility when we consider online registration's benefits for working-class people, parents, and differently abled folks. In the context of working long and often odd hours and or with limited ability to travel, online voter registration significantly improves Minnesotans' access to voting. In 2012, Minnesota voted down restrictive amendment that would have made it harder for students, veterans, rural Minnesotans, people of color, and the differently abled to vote. In doing so, we made it clear that Minnesota is interested in
expanding access to voting, and an online voter registration tool is the next logical steps in this expansion. I encourage you to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have any questions from the committee? No, thanks for your time. And Max Halperin, Citizens for Election Integrity Minnesota. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, name, members of the committee, thank you. I am Max Halperin. I'll clarify, I'm not today representing Citizens for Election Integrity. I am a professor of computer science at Gustavus Adolphus College, with a particular interest in technology for election administration. As a technologist, you might expect that I would focus on why it is I'm convinced online registration can be adequately secure in Minnesota. I'd be happy to answer any questions on that, but I want to focus on the personal experiences that lead me not to conclude that online registration is feasible, but that it's important, vitally important. In fall of 2012, I taught a course on election administration topics, and I asked the students to engage themselves with the election process that fall. And we understood that in our community we had many first-time voters and many individuals who had moved recently, and so registration would be an important topic. So one group of students chose to put on an on-campus registration event, and there was a publicity component to that. And then one evening, the students and I set up in the college dining hall tables, chairs, stack of voter registration forms, other supplies, and the flow of registrants was heavy for the entire couple hours we were there. We had our hands very full explaining how to properly fill out the form and then checking that each registrant had done so. We had to point out where sections were accidentally skipped over, where registrants confused mailing and residential addresses, where despite our best instructions, instead of putting Nicolette on the county line, they put USA, you know, that sort of thing. And most of those things could be corrected in place. There were, however, a number of cases where we had to have the registrant shred the form and start over with a fresh one. At the end of that evening, we wiped our brow. I asked the students how they felt. They were all pumped, psyched. They felt really good about having worked so hard that evening. And as a result, 232 already pre-checked voter registration applications were on their way to the county auditor's office. Later, November, whatever it was, 4th, I think, election day, 2012, a second group of students worked at the polling place as election judges along with me. And it was at that time that we discovered that all that hard work by the first group had just put a dent into the demand for voter registration. At the precinct where the majority of the students live, we processed 767 election day registrations, and there were hundreds more at each of the three other precincts in St. Peter. And when we went through that, it was very rewarding, but to say it was stressful would be an understatement. And we, of course, talked with the other more experienced election judges, and what we heard from them was that they had long held a fervent wish for something that would shift more of the registration to the period before election day and less of it for them to do at the polling place. So after the election, we had a kind of lessons learned discussion, and one of the conclusions we reached was that online registration could play a big role in taking that pressure off the election judges, that there would be more of our students on the web than in the dining hall on any given evening, and that the computer's ability to check thousands of applications for completeness was just unbeatable. And so it is that 14 months later, I'm just absolutely delighted that the very representatives who were elected that November are now addressing this problem. I'm happy to see this bill, and I'd be glad to take any questions.
Thank you for your time. Do we have any questions from the committee? I don't see any. And thanks a lot for your service as an election judge. Appreciate that. Representative Simon, do you have any closing comments? Just one moment. I know that we're coming up on the end time for our committee hearing, but I do want to be sure that if there's anybody who wasn't on the list to be heard on this bill has been heard. Don't see anybody jumping up, so we'll let you go ahead and close. On
thanks, Madam Chair. I don't have a lot to say. Simon. I think okay. Everything that needed to be said has been said. Other than that, I pledge to all committee members this is a beginning, not an end, mm-hmm. like much of what we do in this committee. By necessity, and not only by necessity because it's the best way to do things, this is a beginning, not an end. So I appreciate particularly hearing the suggestions, whether by Mr. McGrath or by Mr. Schmidt or others, about how we can make this better. I'll be in contact with members of both sides of the aisle to take all submissions. And you know, we've got just about a month to regular session, and hopefully we can come up with some sort of consensus bill. So thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you.
Members, before we go on to something else, I want to know how many members here have conflicts and other committees starting, because my inclination is, just very briefly, because it was on the agenda and because it is an important issue, to provide Representative Halverson with the opportunity, even if just for 10 minutes, to give an overview of the bill, because it too, as I'm sure she'll attest, is a work in progress. So do any members have conflicts, or let's put it this way, any objections to going another 10 minutes or so?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that might not be a bad idea just to quickly go through it. And I don't know if people came specifically today to right. testify on this bill. If they did, I think it's appropriate that we hear from them. I can stick around for just a few minutes. Okay. But what I would ask then is just so long as we can maybe talk about this again at a future subsequent. And I think that's the plan, but I just want to make sure. No.
And as Representative Halverson is making her way up, I'll just say that, you know, this too is one of those issues that really requires bipartisan input here. This has to do with not only us, but all public officials, and you know, both caucuses have to be comfortable with it, and I know Representative Halverson is trying to make sure that happens. So Representative Halverson, to your bill, House File 1961.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will be brief. The bill itself is fairly brief. By way of introduction, I'm sure that most of you have heard or seen news reports heard from different organizations that have seen Minnesota rated quite lowly when it comes to public integrity for elections. When they survey statewide what different laws exist in different states to hold elected officials accountable with potential conflicts of interest gifts and those types of things, Minnesota has a very strong gift ban, and we tend to rate very high on those lists. And I think any of us who live in the state, anytime there's a list published about the best states, we always look to the top 10 to see where Minnesota sits. Interestingly enough, we sit 25, so we're right in the middle of the pack on this list from the Center for Public Integrity. And so taking a look at what some of the concerns are, being in contact with some organizations, including the Campaign Finance and Disclosure Board, they had some recommendations with how we might deal with this in legislation. And this bill reflects a start in working on these particular issues. I think that one of the things that I began to think of when I was looking at this legislation is recognizing the fact that Minnesota has a reputation nationwide of being a state of high integrity. Our elected officials, those of you sitting around the table, tend to have a very good reputation of high integrity amongst the general public. And so I don't see approaching this particular piece of legislation in any kind of
punitive way, but really taking the value of high integrity that Minnesota values and providing some additional transparency and some additional ability for the public to understand what any potential conflicts of interest that may exist with elected officials and appointed officials. So with that, I can just briefly go through the three sections of the bill as it's drafted today, and this is a starting point. In fact, I've got a meeting scheduled with Mr. Goldsmith from the Campaign Finance Disclosure Board to go over some of their additional recommendations. So this will, the next time you see it, it will likely be amended, and it will change. But to begin with, one of the top concerns that has been stated about Minnesota's disclosure is our audits, and that we have had permissive language with regard to audits for both campaigns and for public disclosure of elected officials. This is probably, I would say, the most aggressive piece of this legislation, and it makes that turns that permissive language into a must language. So the Campaign Finance Disclosure Board must provide audits within the limits of their available resources. Secondly, we add one piece of disclosure to potential conflicts, and that piece is spousal potential conflicts of interest. And as you know, we have, as legislators, have certain obligations to step away from an issue if we have the potential to benefit directly from a particular vote that we take in ways that the general public wouldn't. It would add spouses to that standard as well. In addition, our economic interest forms would also include spouses. And that's a change that has been recommended by numerous organizations, we believe that this is an opportunity for additional transparency, knowing that most family income is combined income, and that our spouses would be included on our economic interest statement. So that is very briefly a little bit about the bill, and as I said, I'm looking forward to working on this issue this session with all of you. Questions?
Members, any questions or comments? Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Halverson, I know, Mr. Chair, some of the questions that we had, you as an attorney, me as a consultant in our private worlds. Representative Halverson, could you walk through what that looks like if you're an attorney? What are you filling out? Are you, and I understand here that there are business or professional activity codes used by the IRS, which hopefully will be given to us and that we won't have to find on our own. But aside from that, what if I'm a consultant or an attorney that has clients, what type of information am I disclosing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Sanders, thank you for bringing that forward. So I'm dealing with new vision issues, and I didn't read the final paragraph of my paper here. But yes, we are also, in response to a lot of requests for additional disclosure, we have added professional activity where individuals are gaining income. Individuals and their spouses are gaining income as private contractors, as attorneys, as individual consultants. And there have been some calls for people to disclose client lists, to disclose particular clients, and I put this idea forward as a bit of a compromise to that. So there are IRS codes that determine certain types of business income from certain industries that can be identified without identifying specific businesses or clients of an organization in order to protect the privacy of those clients that are choosing to do business with an individual contractor.
Representative Sanders.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Halverson, then it's really just filling in the code, then, of the...
Yes.
Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair, I think that's a really good start.
Okay. Yeah, and just incidentally, you know, I know we talked about this offline, too. It's tough when there is one. I think California requires, mm-hmm. to some extent, listing clients. And I can just speak from the standpoint of attorneys. I don't do criminal defense work, but if I did, what if someone came in and let's say a business person, and said, I need to talk to you, I need to lawyer up, because I think I and or my company is the subject of an FBI investigation. No charges or anything yet, an investigation. However, I don't want anyone to know that I've even retained a lawyer, because the minute the street finds out I've retained a lawyer, the stock price will plunge and I'll be in trouble. And so there's a tension there between the public maybe wanting to know a list of clients, but then things like the attorney-client privilege, and then there are similar difficulties with other types of consultants. Maybe someone is a consultant for an entity that doesn't want it known that they have a legislator or a Democrat or a Republican working for them, and that could damage the relationship too. So this seems like, to me at least, a pretty good compromise. Not disclosing client names, but at least sectors. It's a starting place. Any other questions, comments, concerns by members? Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Representative Simon. Representative Halverson, we were just wondering, have you cleared this with your spouse?
Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erdahl, after much deliberation, yes, I have cleared this with my spouse.
Is there anyone else in the audience here to testify or comment on this bill? Mr. Schroeder. Just identify yourself for the record, please.
Sure. My name is Jeremy Schroeder. I'm the Executive Director of Common Cause Minnesota. Members of the committee, thank you so much for having me here today, and I'll be extremely, extremely brief. First of all, I want to thank the representative for saying that this really is a start. You know, we at Common Cause would love to have stricter standards, and we believe this is a good compromise to get this discussion going. Government can't operate without the trust of its constituents, and that trust depends on officials being above reproach. Spousal disclosure is a way for public servants to have a grown-up conversation with their constituents about the realities of public office and to demonstrate their absolute commitment to open, ethical governance. House File 1961 sends a clear message that public officials hold the public interest as their number one priority, regardless of their personal circumstances. House File 1961 is also a step that over 36 states have already taken, many of them requiring stricter disclosure than what this current bill is proposing. I urge you to adopt House File 1961 and build on the steps you've already taken to validate the trust of your constituents. Thank you very, very much for your time, and I'll answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Schroeder. Anyone have a question for Mr. Schroeder? Okay, thank you very much.
You.
Anyone else here to testify on the bill or to comment on the bill? Okay, I'm not seeing anyone. Any other member comments, questions, concerns? Okay. If not, members, thanks for your indulgence in going over the time limit. Really appreciate it. We'll be back here in a month. Again, I think both of these bills are good examples of beginnings, not endings. And I know I and Representative Halverson. Oh, I'm sorry, sir. Pardon me.
Yeah.
Yes, of course you can. My mistake. Just introduce yourself for the record, please.
Yeah, I'm Bob Auden. I'm representing the Libertarian Party of Minnesota. You know, you got spouse down here, and I was just thinking, why don't you add, like, children, grandchildren, uncles, aunts, I mean, business partners. You don't know what your business partners are into, but maybe you should know. I don't know. And I found it interesting here that the public or local official must orally inform the supervisor, and I have a feeling that that would be used in every instance where they hadn't actually done a written one, and then there's no penalty for not stating that you have an interest. I mean, to me, I mean, you know, I get the idea. You know, we want ethics. We want to know if there's a special interest, but I don't think this really goes anywhere near far enough.
Representative Halverson, care to respond?
Mr. Chair, just that we are certainly starting this conversation with this bill, and we wanted to have something specific for folks to react to. With regard to the oral reporting language, that's what is currently in statute, and I believe that it's a situation that it addresses situations where we would recuse ourselves from votes on a particular issue. So we would have to give state reason why and recuse ourselves. So,
okay, sir.
But we can continue to talk about that.
Sir, could you just spell your last name, please? I didn't quite get it.
I didn't understand what you said.
Could you spell your last name just for the record?
Oh, O-D-D-E-N.
Okay. Thank you.
O-D-D-E-N.
Okay. So. Great. Anything else, sir?
Again, I'm sorry. I'm hearing impaired, I guess. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Anything else? Any more testimony or comments?
No. I just don't think it goes far enough.
Fair enough. Members, thank you for your time and attention. We'll be back here in about a month. Meeting is adjourned.